that has been, domestic discontent has been enormous, and Aliyev has, the authoritarianism in Azerbaijan has been nourished by the oil, by the pipelines. With the collapse of the Soviet Union, Azerbaijan emerged as an independent country and started to control its oil resources. Unfortunately,
we have 5 seconds.
Yeah, this authoritarianism, this militarism has not been challenged, and we see this playing out in Nagorno-Karabakh.
And we'll, of course, continue to follow this. Anna Ohanian, thanks so much for being with us, professor of political science and international relations at Stonehill College. Her books include Russia Abroad. That does it for our show. Stay safe, wear a mask, save lives. I mean.
Listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. Due to the temporary closure of in-station activity at KBOO, meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available at our website. The Finance Committee meets on the third Thursday of the month at 4:30 p.m. Please visit our website at kboo.fm to verify if a meeting is being held.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, federal agents and officers of the Portland Police Bureau reportedly targeted medics during June and July protests. Yesterday, Oregon recorded a record number of cases of COVID-19 and 11 additional deaths. And 49,000 Oregonians are still waiting to receive unemployment benefits. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, October 9th, 2020. I'm Nat Moon. Yesterday, the Oregon Health Authority reported a record of 484 new cases of COVID-19, along with 11 more deaths. Thursday's numbers beat the previous daily record of 457 new cases set in late September, and mark the ninth time that Oregon has reported over 400 new cases in a single day. It also marks the second highest number of daily deaths since the start of the pandemic and brings the weekly average to 322 new cases per day. The state has now reported a total of 594 fatalities due to coronavirus. In Portland, significant increases were recorded in Multnomah County with 82 new cases, Washington County with 58, and Clackamas County with 31. Klamath, Marion, and Lane counties also reported increases, with health officials pointing to a workplace outbreak among seasonal strawberry harvesters as a big contributor to Klamath County's jump. 54 of the 452 workers tested before harvest were positive and were later placed in protected housing. Modeling suggests numbers will continue to rise through the end of the month, especially as testing capacity drastically increases. On Wednesday, Oregon's largest school district, Portland Public Schools, announced it was extending distance learning through the end of January. Governor Brown urged Oregonians yesterday to limit social gatherings in days to come, tweeting, quote, "You can make a difference. It's up to each of us what happens next." According to a report released yesterday, medics were specifically targeted by law enforcement officers during summer protests in Portland. The report covering the months of June and July was compiled by the nonprofit group Physicians for Human Rights and covers the period when agents from the Department of Homeland Security and other federal agencies participated in crowd control at the federal courthouse in downtown Portland. And although the report notes that the number and severity of injuries increased substantially after the arrival of federal agents, it attributed the increase in injuries to both federal agents and the Portland Police Bureau. The PHR described behavior of law enforcement as, quote, cruel, inhuman, or degrading, and stated that after the arrival of federal agents, officers were more likely to shoot less lethal munitions, including rubber bullets and tear gas canisters, directly at protesters and medics. During the protests, the police frequently would not allow medical professionals to access the protest sites, so volunteer medics would step in. Among those quoted in the report were two former emergency medical technicians, a veteran combat medic, and a neuroscientist. All say they were deliberately targeted as they treated injured protesters. Those injuries included head, face, and eye injuries, severe lacerations, and chemical burns. Medics described treating facial lacerations that were cut to the bone. In the report, PHR Medical Director Dr. Michelle Heisler said, quote, some would argue that it meets the criteria for torture. Heisler compared the results in Portland to what she saw in research after the brutal repression of the 2013 Gezi Parka uprising in Turkey. She said that what she saw in Portland was more severe and that, quote, many of the injuries would have been far more serious if people didn't have protective equipment. According to a report in The Guardian, PPB spokesperson Lieutenant Greg Pashley referred to existing police policies on the use of force in crowd control. And Jim Middaugh, a spokesperson for Mayor Ted Wheeler, said, quote, there is a lot of work to be done to ensure that the whole community feels safe around the PPB. The federal government is refusing to pay over $3.5 million in fines imposed by the city of Portland. The fines relate to the fencing that surrounds the federal courthouse, as well as the environmental impact of tear gas used on protesters. At a rate of $48,000 per day, the Portland Bureau of Transportation has so far imposed $3.7 million in fines for blocking the bike lanes around the Marco Hatfield Federal Courthouse. And as a result of tear gas residue fouling the city's stormwater system, the Bureau of Environmental Services began imposing fines at the rate of $20,000 per day starting on September 10th. The BES found higher than usual heavy metal concentrations in several catch basins near the courthouse. According to BES spokesperson Diane Dulkin, the agency was trying to gain access to the storm drain to, quote, assess its condition, clean sediment as needed, and make sure the storm drain functions to prevent street flooding. They have been unable to access all the drains that needed testing because at least one is blocked by the concrete that anchors the fences. Portland's storm drain system empties into the Willamette River. But according to David Hess, assistant director for the Federal Protective Service, the federal government is, quote, absolutely immune from fines or penalties issued by local governments unless there is a waiver of sovereign immunity by Congress. That waiver of immunity has not been granted. Oregon's Sustainable Building Week highlights ways in which homeowners can reduce their carbon footprint. For more on the story, here's Eric Tegedoff of the Oregon News Service.
Next week, Oregonians will get a peek into the greener future of homes. Monday is the start of the third annual Sustainable Building Week, kicking off a series of events happening virtually this year. It includes a virtual Go Zero tour of Oregon homes that produce as much energy as they consume. Zach Snyder with Solar Oregon says residential buildings consume one quarter of all the energy used in Oregon.
What's so great is that the technology for zero energy homes, which could reduce that huge amount of energy that we consume in residential buildings, is already here.
Snyder notes solar energy plays an important role in sustainability, as well as energy efficiency measures. Sustainable Building Week actually features 2 weeks of events highlighting technology that can help homeowners and renters reduce their home's carbon footprint. The growing effects from climate change are driving conversations about zero-energy homes. Snyder says that's especially true in Oregon after the wildfire-ravaged summer.
I know that climate is at the forefront more and more of the public mind, and the fires definitely have created a sense of urgency because they were particularly devastating this year.
Snyder adds the green economy also is creating jobs. According to the Solar Foundation, there were more than 3,700 solar jobs in Oregon in 2019, growing more than 2.5% from the previous year. For Oregon News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
According to a report in today's Oregonian, the majority of Oregon's renters were able to pay rent in October. But with delayed unemployment payments, widespread furloughs, and cuts to business hours, the COVID-19 housing crisis is far from over, and debt is piling up for those who have fallen behind. Data shows 85 to 87% of Oregonians were able to make full or partial rent payments this month, only 5% lower than last year's numbers. According to Portland Housing Bureau estimates, that equates to over $120 million in total tenant debt by the end of September. And not surprisingly, the state's lower-income tenants have been hit hardest, with only 72% able to make full or partial payments by October 6th. While eviction moratoriums were extended through the end of the year, both locally and nationwide, no provisions have been made for rent forgiveness or payment support. This means tenants who are accumulating rent debt will be expected to pay the total amount due once the moratorium ends on January 8th. Tenants will then have 6 months to pay back any missing rent before facing possible eviction. As a result, experts are warning that without additional assistance from Congress, next year could see a record number of evictions nationwide. On a Wednesday call with reporters, Acting Oregon Employment Department Director David Gerstenfeld estimated that roughly 49,000 Oregonians are still waiting for their unemployment claims to be adjudicated. Adjudication is the process applicants must go through when there are questions surrounding their request for benefits. Last week, he confirmed that the process had been completed for nearly 150,000 applicants, and $225 million in long-awaited benefits had been paid out. But for the remaining 49,000, the wait continues, and many have been waiting for their review since they initially filed in March. Gerstenfeld said that in addition to hiring more adjudicators and speeding up their training, the department has also contracted with third-party companies to help in the process. But during Wednesday's call, he admitted that they still have difficulty keeping applicants up to date on where they stand. He said, quote, "We are still struggling to get through the work as quickly as possible and trying to balance the time spent communicating about where people are in the process and the time spent trying to get through the process more quickly." Gerstenfeld said he will provide an update next week, including a goal for when the department will be able to work through the remaining backlog. A recent poll shows Portland mayoral challenger Sarah Iannarone has a lead in the race against incumbent Ted Wheeler. KBOO's Ray Bodwell has these thoughts. This commentary is the opinion of the reporter.
A recent poll by the Portland Business Alliance shows that challenger Sarah Iannarone has an 11-point lead over incumbent Mayor Ted Wheeler. Now, your first impulse might be to assume that this is just Portland's vocal progressive community lining up behind her. But I'll bet if you talk to people in the Pearl or downtown, many of them would also support Sarah. And if asked, many of those people might label themselves as moderates or liberals, but they no longer have any faith in Ted. Whether through higher property taxes, higher rents, inflated parking fees, or a myriad of other increased costs, they have been paying a premium for the alleged benefits of living in Center City. But since mid-March, those advantages have disappeared and frequently turned into disadvantages. Of course, no one blames the pandemic on the mayor, and to be fair, his immediate response was reasonably competent. But for downtown and Pearl residents, it's been all downhill ever since. The murder of George Floyd by the Minneapolis police legitimately outraged most Portlanders. But in the 4 months since that outrage, little has been done to convince business owners that it's safe to remove the plywood shields many still feel the necessity to hide behind. And when that initial outrage turned into nightly protests against an aggressive police department with a history of violence against people of color, the inability or unwillingness of the mayor, who is also the police commissioner, to rein in his police department caused many who live or work in Center City to seriously doubt his grasp of the problem or his leadership skills. And while those nightly clashes were drawing the media attention, Center City was slowly being overwhelmed by the tragedy of homelessness, mental illness, and drug addiction. If you walk or drive through Center City, you will quickly see that this tragedy has become one of the dominant visuals in Portland's doorways, sidewalks, and parks, and its victims sit, stand, and aimlessly wander about, a mute testimony to our growing mental health and a homeless crisis. Not only has the mayor failed to address this tragedy in any meaningful way over the last 4 years, but the recent placement of porta potties around the city for use by those living on the streets has clearly demonstrated that not only does Wheeler not have a plan, but he assumes that these folks will remain on the streets for the foreseeable future. Does Sarah Iannarone have all or even some of the answers? I don't know. And some have questioned both her experience and her personal style. But she has stated that she will name Commissioner Joanne Hardesty as police commissioner if she is elected. And last week, Hardesty published a detailed plan of action for the PPB if she's named commissioner. That's a huge start. Beyond that, who knows? And let's face it, Portland's archaic form of government has produced a series of one-term mayors. If Iannarone is elected, she may just be the next in that legacy. But at this point, Mayor Wheeler has done little to demonstrate the vision and leadership we've desperately needed during this the worst year in living memory. I don't think Iannarone can be worse, and she may be better, and I'm willing to give her a shot at it. For KBOO, this is Ray Bodwell.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Coming up next at 5:30, it's Counterspin. At 6, it's Rising Up with Sana Lee. Then at 7, The Struggle with Alyssa Pariah. Tonight, we can expect rain with temperatures dipping into the high 50s. Tomorrow, we'll see continuing rain showers with a daytime high of about 60. On this day in 1949, Harvard Law School began admitting women. Today's quote is from the late Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who said, quote, "When I'm sometimes asked, when will there be enough women on the Supreme Court? And I say, when there are 9, people are shocked. But there had been 9 men, and nobody's ever raised a question about that." Amid rising fears around the potential for violence associated with the November general election, the FBI announced the arrest of 6 men on charges of conspiracy to kidnap Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer. With more on the story and others, it's Lily Bolke with 2020 Talks.
Welcome to 2020 Talks, where we track the 2020 elections in uncharted territory.
When I put my hand on the Bible and took the oath of office 22 months ago, I knew this job would be hard. But I'll be honest, I never could have imagined anything like this.
That's Michigan's Governor Gretchen Whitmer after terrorism and conspiracy charges were brought against 13 men who had allegedly been planning to storm the state capitol building, kidnap her, and start a civil war. The FBI said since the summer, some of the men had gathered multiple times to discuss the mission, practice firearms training, and combat drills. In April, President Trump openly encouraged armed Michiganders at the state capitol protesting coronavirus health and safety precautions, tweeting, quote, "Liberate Michigan."
When our leaders speak, their words matter. They carry weight. When our leaders meet with, encourage, or fraternize with domestic terrorists, they legitimize their actions. And they are complicit.
Igor Volsky with Guns Down America says firearms need to be kept out of public spaces, including protests, state capitals, and polling places. He hopes the increased presence of armed intimidators is a wake-up call for states to tighten regulations.
Those voices that were previously pushed to the fringe of our national conversation now have a platform and now believe that they are entitled to use their firearms in order to suppress people's constitutional rights.
In recent debates, neither President Trump nor Vice President Mike Pence would commit to a peaceful transfer of power if they lose the election. Democratic Representative Barbara Lee from California joined the African American Policy Forum yesterday to discuss the VP debate.
I think it's important to recognize how vulnerable what's left of this democracy is because they made a mockery out of it.
Senator Kamala Harris is the first Black woman to debate on the vice presidential stage. Yesterday, in an interview with Fox Business Channel, Trump, in a personal attack, called her a, quote, monster and, quote, totally unlikable, language often used to describe strong women's behavior when similar actions would be viewed positively for a man. Research shows many women in politics face a double standard, especially women of color. Barbara Arnwine with the Transformative Justice Coalition thought Harris's authenticity was powerful.
It was not the litigator people predicted. It was not the angry woman. It was not the woman that people told us to expect that they would, you know, send her in kind of trying to be, you know, as nice as she could. It was just her.
And the Biden and Trump campaign sparred over the next presidential debate after the debate commission announced it would be done remotely for safety. Trump rejected a virtual debate, so the Biden campaign has begun planning its own town hall event that night. White House physician Sean Conley said yesterday that Trump is done with treatment and will return to public events Saturday, less than 2 weeks after his COVID diagnosis. From Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Lily Bolke. Thanks for listening at pacificanetwork.org and publicnewsservice.org.
Financial stress associated with the COVID-19 pandemic has become a significant health risk for many Americans. For more on that, here's Roz Brown with the Public News Service.
Even before the pandemic, nearly 40% of people in the U.S. said they wouldn't be able to cover a surprise $400 expense, and the health crisis has only made things worse. A survey by Money Magazine and Morning Consult shows 11% of Americans report being very stressed about credit card debt, with nearly 30% saying their reliance on credit cards for food and self-care items has increased since the pandemic began. Bradley Klontz is a financial therapist who describes COVID-19 as a psychological earthquake that has induced stress at unprecedented levels.
Money is the number one source of stress in the lives of Americans, even when times are great. So we're the wealthiest country in the world, yet this is the biggest source of stress in our lives as Americans.
In New Mexico, more than 100,000 people lost jobs in April in the financial fallout from the pandemic, but economists say roughly one-third of those jobs have come back. At the same time, state economists told lawmakers this week they believe many New Mexicans have left the labor force entirely. Klontz says job loss, loss of a loved one, and caregiving responsibilities combined with financial difficulties have made the pandemic a life-changing event for many people. He encourages anyone who's struggling to track spending, cut all unnecessary expenses, locate resources for emergency food if necessary, and find someone to talk to if stress levels are causing depression.
The problem is, for most Americans, your finances won't actually kill you. However, your financial stress can kill you. It's really, really dangerous to be living in that level of financial stress.
The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention has published a guide to coping with stress related to COVID-19 on its website, cdc.gov. For Public News Service, I'm Roz Brown.
On Thursday, the team of Joe Biden and Kamala Harris shared their plan for strengthening government-to-government relationships with tribal nations. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Democratic presidential candidate Joe Biden and running mate Kamala Harris released their plan for tribal nations Thursday. They committed to strengthening government-to-government relationships, improving healthcare, public safety, education, and economic development, and address climate change and veterans issues. During a visit to Phoenix, Arizona Thursday, Biden and Harris met with leaders of the Tohono O'odham Nation, Gila River Indian Community, Hopi Tribe, San Carlos Apache Tribe, and the Navajo Nation. Following the meeting, they toured the Veterans Memorial at the Heard Museum and gave a short video message to the Navajo Nation, which was posted online by the tribe.
Navajo Nation, stay strong. We need you. We need you. We need you. Need you. And you're going to have a seat at the table if we get elected.
We are going to always fight for sovereignty. We're going to fight to work together on the climate and what we know the original people always knew, which is that we have to protect this earth and we have to be smart about it. We will take your lead. You will always have a seat at the table.
Other campaign promises include reinstating the annual White House Tribal Nations Conference, appointing a Native American to a high-level government position, and defending the Indian Child Welfare Act. Indigenous Peoples Day will be celebrated in cities across the country Monday, including in Montana, where some cities have dropped Columbus Day. Eric Tigetoff has more.
Marcia Small is an earth sciences doctoral student at Montana State University who's leading the push to observe Indigenous Peoples Day statewide. She wants everyone to think about their ancestors on Monday.
We need to have respect for each other and celebrate each other rather than create more divisiveness. Let's create a collectiveness that moves toward a better horizon.
To commemorate the day, Montana State University is hosting Joy Harjo, the current U.S. Poet Laureate and the first Native American to hold the title. Small also encourages people to look into the Native history of the place they live.
Learn the lands on which you are on. Learn what that land used to be.
Bozeman and Missoula have recognized Indigenous Peoples Day since 2016. Helena and Harlem, a city near the Fort Belknap Reservation, joined them in 2019. I'm Eric Tegedoff.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
The rapid expansion of 5G technology across the country has raised renewed concerns about excessive exposure to electromagnetic radiation. For more on that, here's Suzanne Potter with the Public News Service.
As the march to install superfast 5G wireless service continues across the country, advocates for patients with electrosensitivity are questioning the technology's safety. Noah Davidson of Sacramento began lobbying to have 5G antennas moved away from people's homes and offices because his 5- and 7-year-old nieces got sick for 2 months straight right after Verizon installed a 5G box on a light pole next to their home. The family hired an expert to measure the radio frequency levels.
So we ended up installing some shielding in the home, moving the kids into a back room, and within a few days, their symptoms went away.
Verizon's website quotes the FCC's guidance that there's no scientific evidence linking radiation from cell phones to health problems in humans, and 5G boxes do meet all legal standards. Davidson wants the decades-old standards updated, saying the technology hasn't been proven safe. 3G and 4G cell antennas are typically mounted on towers 50 to 200 feet above ground, but the 5G small cell boxes are more localized, generally placed every 7 or 8 houses about 30 feet off the ground. Dr. David Carpenter, a public health research physician at the University of Albany and an expert on RF radiation, says some people do fall ill when exposed to non-ionizing radiation from cell phones, smart meters, and components of the 5G cell sites, boxes that are now being installed across the nation.
But there are a lot of people that get ringing in their ears or get headaches and feel fatigued and their brain isn't working quite right that never think about the fact that it may be coming from the Wi-Fi in their house or the smart meter on the outside door.
A recent study from UC Irvine in the medical journal Multiple Sclerosis and Related Disorders finds extreme RF exposure can produce severe illness that mimics MS. It looks at the case of 47-year-old Rick Garwood, a former cell phone tower technician from Southern California. He was exposed to massive radiation amounts in 2011 when a Verizon worker switched the towers back on after they'd been shut down for maintenance. Garwood says he's now on permanent disability, suffering with nodules on his lungs and painful lesions on his brain, kidney, and spinal cord.
The person I was is gone. I mean, I've lost everything in life. I had to move back to my parents' home. I'm on permanent disability. I went from a $80,000 a year career to all of a sudden, I was on workers' comp for 4.5 years, and then they finally said, you're not going to get any better.
Garwood sued, went to mediation, and received about a year's pay. For Public News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
The installation of more EV charging stations is making it easier for drivers with electric cars to make long trips. For more on that, here's Dr. Anthony Lizowitz with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Many people appreciate the environmental benefits of electric cars, but they may hesitate to buy one because they worry that the car's battery might run out of power on long trips.
We realized early on that to convince EV drivers to consider EVs as a daily driving car, You needed to be able to go anywhere you wanted at any time.
That's Wayne Killen of Electrify America. The company is creating two EV-friendly corridors by installing charging stations along major east-to-west highways. One runs from Washington, D.C. to Los Angeles. Another, from Jacksonville to San Diego, should be complete by the end of the year. The charging stations on these routes will be about 70 miles apart, well within the range of most electric vehicles, so EV drivers can more easily travel state to state, or even across the country. And though charging times are not as quick as filling up with gas, Killen expects most drivers will spend less than 30 minutes powering up.
Because obviously you don't want to stop and wait hours when you're on a, say, a 500-mile trip for your EV to charge up.
So he says the new charging routes will help drivers feel more confident that they can get where they're going without running out of power. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Friday, October 9th, 2020. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast is Ray Bodwell and Samantha Lau. The producer is Ray Bodwell, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Lily Bolke, Antonio Gonzalez, and Eric Tegedoff. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Nat Moon.